Well, happy Thursday and welcome to Perspectives on WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thank you so much for tuning in our direction on the radio. And you all can also be part of the proceedings via phone and email. That phone number, 850-414-1234, perspectives@wfsu.org is the email address. And we are going to start off the proceedings today with a couple of late-breaking headlines. Here's one. Dateline Washington, training materials on the subject of human trafficking are most effective when tailored to specific industry sectors. That from Candace Paris, executive director of Truckers Against Trafficking. Paris's comments came just 2 days ago, marking the second public meeting of the U.S. Department of Transportation's Advisory Committee on Human Trafficking. She serves as the chairwoman of the agency's subcommittee on training and awareness. And a whole bunch of members of the transportation industry, including truckers, taxi drivers, toll operators, rest stop workers, and transit rail employees, need to look for different indicators when trying to spot signs of human trafficking. That's just one. Another one came in this morning from the University of Richmond. Robert Kraft, remember him? New England Patriots billionaire owner recently made headlines when he was charged with two counts of soliciting prostitution. The women involved were undocumented Chinese immigrants who were human trafficking victims at the Orchids of Asia Spa in Jupiter, Florida. Raids and sting operations like this one, which ensnared about 100 other far less prominent alleged perpetrators and a few other very rich men, have become commonplace across the U.S. and the world. And one last article, this one, Associated Press, Dateline Lincoln, Nebraska. Nebraska lawmakers are considering another effort to clamp down on human trafficking by increasing and in some cases eliminating the statute of limitations for the crime. This bill was presented yesterday to the legislature's Judiciary Committee. It would increase the statute of limitations for labor or sex trafficking of an adult and abolish it if the victim was a minor. And that just within the past 24 hours. There have been lots more headlines that have been coming out just in the past few weeks. And so we are revisiting this issue of human trafficking in our area and beyond, particularly since the Florida legislature is now also debating this issue very aggressively at the moment. So we welcome back to the microphones of Perspectives, first, Susan Turner, Survive and Thrive Advocacy Center, otherwise known as STAC, board member and co-owner of Food Glorious Food. Susan, it is good to see you again so soon.
So soon. Thank you so much for having us back again. It's a real pleasure.
Well, it is certainly timely, and we're so happy that Robin was able to get everybody back online. We say hey again to Terry Coonan, Executive Director, FSU Center for the Advancement of Human Rights and STAC Community Partner. Hey, Terry.
Hello, Tom. Good morning.
You're looking forward to that St. Paddy's Day celebration this weekend, I see.
I am. We're within the octave now of celebrating the High Holy Day.
Indeed it is. Well, we will probably see you down at Lake Ella. That's what we were talking about last week on Perspectives. Derek Phillips joins us, too. He is owner and grower-farmer of Handsome Harvest Farm over in Quincy, and donor of Trafficking and Slavery-Free Food to the upcoming March 28th event. More on that to come, but Derek, it is good to meet you, sir.
Thank you, Tom. I'm very happy to be here.
And how's everything growing over in Quincy for you?
It's a busy time of year, but things are growing real well with the nice weather we've been having.
Isn't that great to have two harvests in Florida, huh?
It's gorgeous, yeah.
Keeps you going. And we could not do this, of course, without Robin Hassler-Thompson, Survive and Thrive Advocacy Center Executive Director. Hey, Robin.
Hi, Tom.
Well, we are back together again, and the reason it's only been a few months since our last meeting is because of the timeliness of this issue. We mentioned some of the headlines on the outflow, but where are we right now in Florida as far as not only what the legislature is looking at, but some of the issues that STAC and other advocacy organizations are involved with?
Well, we're going strong. I think that our legislature does have several bills that they're looking at this session, and certainly that's gotten some press attention. And every time that happens, we know that the opportunity is there to get the word out about this being a reality, and not just in the parts of Florida that people see getting some of the bigger headlines, like Palm Beach County or Broward County or Orlando, it's going on right here in our area, and that's why STACK exists.
So. Well, that's and before we went on the air, Terry Cooney, you were saying in the wake of Hurricane Michael and here in the Northwest Florida area that was so badly impacted by the storm, this then becomes fertile ground for this sort of activity, right?
It does, Tom. And what we're seeing is that there's been a number of labor trafficking victims that our Human Rights Center is working with in collaboration with STACK. These are, for the most part, Latino males. They have been recruited to come in from Mexico, from Guatemala. A number of them recruited around the country, including minors who were brought down here and exploited, exploited in the roofing and the rebuilding industry. So that sadly, it's an example of where we see trafficking following natural disasters. And we now understand that a lot of these young men and not so young men are being victimized by traffickers who are often the subcontractors. It's the subcontractors who recruit these workers. They're then often put in very, very isolated parts of the panhandle. One victim we worked with slept with 18 other people in a single room trailer, wasn't paid, was intimidated. Told by the trafficker that he actually enjoys close relationships with law enforcement and with narco traficantes, drug traffickers back in the home country. So classic examples of where coercion and fraud are being used. That it's not a case of people working with guns held to their heads, but rather fraud and psychological coercion, which are the other two hallmarks of how our prosecutors can go after trafficking.
So maybe our perception, the face of human trafficking, may be somewhat in error because we do have these very vivid mental images. And again, some of it kind of, I don't know, kicked off by, I won't say where, but women wrapped in duct tape springs to mind here. But it is a much broader range of people who are victims than just that.
And the labor trafficking in particular hides in plain sight. When we do trainings, we tell folks that you have to forget everything you learned from the movie Taken and Liam Neeson going after sex traffickers. No, we actually have far more labor trafficking cases here in Florida. We've, of course, had some high-profile sex trafficking out of the South Florida Massage Parlor Network. But what we're really seeing is that the labor trafficking hides in plain sight, and that we're seeing it here in North Central Florida, and in particular in the wake of the hurricane.
Let me jump over here, if we could, to Derek Phillips. And Derek, again, since Gadsden County is primarily agricultural, as it has been historically, and you guys, of course, are carrying on that grand tradition, but there's been, at least anecdotally, a lot of emphasis on places like Gadsden County as possibly sites for labor trafficking to take part. What are you seeing on the ground over there?
Well, you know, you can see living in Gadsden County that there is a community of Salvadorian people out there that do mainly staff the tomato farms. Personally, though, what I have been more involved with is a small organic movement that's coming into the county. I've had my farm for the past year, and I started at another local organic farm, Full Earth Farm. It's also in Quincy. So what I'm seeing is, in a small way, a transition to use these really healthy soils that have been used for decades in the past and making a more positive transition.
All right, so this is something now that is going on. Maybe there will never be a wholesale departure from the business model of the factory-type farm or the large corporate agricultural industry that we have here in this country, but there seems to be a resurgence of the small, individually owned farm like yours and many others with the Red Hill Farm Alliance and all. That is really gaining traction in this area, right?
Well, you know, it's something that's kind of debatable as we are facing the future of global warming. We have to look at what our agricultural practices are, and some of these large-scale farms aren't going to be sustainable as we're moving towards a carbon-neutral future. So right now, what would be the best way to support a movement towards sustainable farming would be customers. You know, in order for this to grow, in order for our small farms to become medium-sized farms and perhaps even large farms, it really takes people to decide that they want to come to the farmers market or to use our online Red Hills market to support these local farms and allow them to grow in that way.
Okay, which brings us to an event that is coming up later on this month. And Susan Turner, you are event organizer for this whole thing. This is all your fault. So talk
yes,
about what's coming
and
up.
Robin. It's a wonderful event. And what we're trying to do is educate people about cooking and eating with a conscience. And that used to mean counting calories, looking for fats and carbs in food. But now we're expanding that awareness to where did your food come from? Who planted it? Who picked it? Who packed it? And it goes into this small farm idea. I think people like the idea of knowing where their food comes from, that it's grown locally. It tends to be healthier. It's closer to the market. And we are so lucky to have wonderful farms, small farms, that are donating to this event. They're donating ingredients. Food Glorious Food is going to prepare it. And then we have other local restaurants who are coming in too. And it's interesting because it's always the smaller restaurants and farms that come up to bat. They're the ones that say, we're here for you. And I think that says a lot about our community.
Well, before we get into the nuts and bolts of the event, which is coming up on March 28th at the Turnbull Center, you said we're still pushing to get some of the larger players involved in this sort of thing. If you have a large chain, you know, one of the Darden restaurant chains or something, how do you get those guys to buy local? Can you?
No, I think it's very difficult. There are a couple of stores. Coalition for Immokalee Workers issues a list of people that are on board that support their initiative. And Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, Walmart is on that list, they have sort of come up to bat, but it's very difficult. It's very difficult to get big corporate companies, you know, to make the change.
Just like Derek has and his compadres have trouble to compete even regionally,
sure,
when it comes to one of the larger entities that's farming in our area. We're talking about human trafficking, not just farming, but also about the abuse of human beings when it comes to this absolute scourge that now the Florida legislature and many other lawmaking bodies around the country are wrestling to deal with. And that is our topic here on Perspectives. We'd love to hear from you, 850-414-1234, or drop us an email, perspectives@wfsu.org. We'll be right back. Organization called Survive and Thrive. It targets human trafficking and is an advocate for the trafficked here in the state of Florida. And we're talking about that on WFSU's Perspectives. A reminder, you can always find the program online at WFSU.org. And we try to have the latest program up within usually 24 hours after it appears on the radio, so you can go back and listen to it if you just tuned in, caught little bits and pieces of it, and you want to hear the entire thing. So anyway, around the table again, Robin Hassler and Derek Phillips and Terry Coonan and Susan Turner. How can you tell, keeping on this food situation here, if what you're buying in the store has potentially been originated by people who have been trafficked? It doesn't have a label on it. How can you tell, Robin?
It doesn't have a label, but I want to tell you the story of one of our food donors for this event and how she has been able to find out. Very simple. She asked. So one of our donors is Mania Chester. She's going to have her wonderful breads at our event. And she said she picked up the phone, called the people who give her flour and yeast and said, where does this come from? And one of those purveyors basically said, I am so glad you asked because we work so hard to make sure that we're sourcing from someplace that has ethical labor practices. So she was assured at that point, hey, I know what's going on. And that's what I love about doing this event is talking to people who really don't know too much about the issue. But when they start inquiring, there's this wonderful flow of information back and forth between farmers. Same thing with David Gwynn had a conversation the other day. They have the Grove Market Cafe in Cypress. They'll be part of this event. And David said, I want to know what to say. I want to know how to ask the questions. What should I ask? And just say, tell it, you know, ask their purveyors, people who give them coffee and all the other things. What do you do? So that's how people can start the conversation, is just asking that question.
Is there any possibility of even, you know, we don't want overarching regulation. We hear about that all the time, and we know where that goes. But gluten-free, there's a label, okay? This makeup was produced without hurting any little animals. We got a label for that. Is there any way to, through the chain of production, certify? I mean, you could do it, Derek. It's no problem, right? I mean, an inspector comes on and says, oops, I don't see any traffic folks here at your farm.
You know, Tom, I wish that I could. I think labeling can be a powerful way for people to change their buying habits. And just like Robin mentioned, even when you come to the farmer's market of today, in order to be able to serve all of our customers, there's oftentimes resellers there that are going to be serving or selling foods that are just being distributed to them. So in that same vein, talk with the farmers there. Ask if they personally grew it and where their farm is. It's a lot of fun to get to know the small farmers. And, you know, you can also be aware of the resellers. And if you perhaps need to pick up something out of season, that can be appropriate too. But I think it's a great idea to find some advocacy agency to start labeling foods to say that it has, you know, appropriate non-slavery-based labor.
And that's really one of our goals, too, with this event.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, it is. What we're asking the people donating food to do is to sign a little statement saying this food is labor traffic free, and we would like to give them some sort of certificate or banner saying the food you're buying at this stand is produced by, you know, free labor.
No human beings were harmed in the production of this food. I mean,
and we fed them and took care of them.
Yeah, it just seems, I don't know. To the phones we go. Tom is awaiting on line one. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hey, it seems to me that the discussion is trafficking. We're going to have to deal with that elephant in the room, which is illegal immigration, because a lot of the people who are coming over to work these jobs and are being exploited or being promised free passage into the U.S. Some of them are getting free visas, like in the case of Chinese workers who are working at Chinese restaurants, and they're obligated supposedly to work for 1 or 2 years for no money at all except for tips. But the deal is that the employer will pay for their airline ticket or their passage into the U.S. in whatever way that's done. Farm workers are given similar guarantees. We'll get you into the U.S. You'll eventually be able to become a citizen if you stay there long enough. The sex traffickers, this is a very big component of that. It's an integral part. And I know it's a polarizing topic because, you know, if you are supporting stopping trafficking, it might sound like you're supporting, you know, building a wall or cracking down on illegal immigration, and that's politically incorrect. But we're going to have to deal with that issue because that is a very vital component of this equation.
That is terrific, Tom. Thank you very much. And Terry Coonan, we had a little discussion along that line before we opened up the microphones here today. Is that what happens typically?
That's part of the issue. We're finding that if someone here is undocumented, or if they're here on a visa that is set to expire, or a visa like a tourist visa that doesn't allow them to work, they're still oftentimes offered employment by an unethical employer. And what we're also seeing is what we see, what we call debt servitude in the law field. For instance, some of the people working in these Chinese massage parlors, they owe $80,000 to $100,000 for having been smuggled into the United States or having had a visa fraudulently secured for them. And that debt is what they then have to pay off. And as Tom, as our visitor mentioned, that becomes the means by which they're exploited. So immigration is part of that, but it's not just illegal immigration. It's actually a great many people who come into the United States legally, but who then have some kind of vulnerability that's then exploited by a trafficker. And what we're also seeing, Tom, is U.S. citizens being exploited. We've had cases, farm cases here in Florida, where veterans who were down on their luck, who were recruited out of homeless shelters, were exploited, say, in the Palatka area, working there. And what we're understanding now is that trafficking is about exploiting a vulnerability. It could be undocumented status. It could be a U.S. citizen child who's a runaway. It could be someone with a substance abuse issue. It's all about exploiting vulnerabilities. And that's, I think, the best paradigm for us to approach this with.
But even carrying on past the exploitation, who makes the money?
Well, that's why we have to do more than just arrest low-level traffickers. We have to, in fact, find ways that we can get at the financial assets, especially of quite profitable large trafficking enterprises. One of the really interesting things that's come out about the Robert Kraft case down in South Florida, well, first of all, the news there really wasn't that it was Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, but the real news was that it was South Florida law enforcement, and especially Sheriff Snyder there, that they were treating the women in those massage parlors as presumptive victims and not as illegal aliens, not as criminals. The real story was how law enforcement used a quite different paradigm for actually looking at that whole illegal enterprise. Ultimately, yeah, we have to get at the money. We have to get at the assets. Here in Florida, one of the things that has been resisted has been giving trafficking victims the right to sue their traffickers. It's been a contentious issue in recent legislative sessions. Part of the issue has derailed on trying to make what we call facilitators liable, for instance, hotels, restaurants, amusement parks. But perhaps what we need to do is rethink that entire debate and think, why don't we give trafficking victims the ability to sue their actual traffickers, to sue the sex traffickers or the labor traffickers who have directly exploited them? It's been absent from the legislative debate. We've got some good bills in front of the legislature this year, but that notion of civil damages, the ability to sue your trafficker, is significantly absent. I don't think that we'll be able to get at trafficking really successfully until we give victims what we call a private right of action, the ability to sue their actual traffickers.
Well, particularly if the victims are undocumented internationals, you have to get them that right then, don't you?
You absolutely do. But you also have to give that U.S. citizen African-American who's been exploited out in Palatka, who's homeless, who might be struggling with substance abuse, you have to give them that same remedy as well. So it's not at all about thinking just about foreign national victims. It's about people with vulnerabilities that continue to be exploited left and right here in the United States.
What specifically, Robin Hessler, is being debated right now at the Florida legislature in regards to all this?
Well, there are a couple of bills. One of the bills that is of particular, I think, importance is one to require that in lodging establishments, that there's going to be a training for everyone in that lodging establishment to recognize trafficking and then to report it. So that kind of mandate with the hospitality industry is really great. It'd be great to see that expanded to other businesses and other places as well. So that is one of the big things that's out there, and I think that that's a really great reform. We're also looking at increased, I don't know if the amendment is going to go on today or did last week, but that four-hour requirement for law enforcement to get human trafficking training, that's out there as well. So those are the kinds of things that I think are really important. And just as Terry was saying, imagine a civil right of action here, and then we're going to have lawyers to understand what trafficking is, to bring those cases, to be aware. So every one of these initiatives that promotes greater awareness and understanding how you, in your professional capacity, could do something about this is important. So we've had events at FSU Law School for the justice system and for lawyers in the community. We've had events at TMH teaching physicians and nurses how to recognize trafficking. I mean, that's the thing about this issue is that it truly takes a village. You need everybody to understand this issue, both to be able to call and report it, and then how to directly help victims. So those are two of the really important things that I've seen.
And a really significant part of Senator Book's proposed bill, in addition to actually really fostering the trainings for our private sector places, but it's also to require law enforcement training, mandatory training for Florida law enforcement that are already on the beat. Since 2008, we've had required trainings for those in the academy who are about to go out and work in law enforcement. But there's been nothing mandated for really the great law enforcement that we already have in police or sheriff's offices all over the country. And here in Florida, having that part of Senator Book's bill is really important.
It's really important. And I have to right now just jump in, if you don't mind, Tom, and give a shout out to Sheriff Walt McNeil, because what he has done, and we were part of this, Terry and I went and trained every road patrol officer at LCSO, all the investigators, school resource deputies, and it's still going on in terms of his promoting the training of new recruits. He developed a standard operating procedure on how to handle these cases. And that's in the infrastructure of the organization. I think it's a model for other sheriff's departments. And just having that comprehensive training, and I hope it's going to be ongoing. I'm sure he'd be open to that. But he is such a great leader on this issue, and we really have to give him a shout out. And at TPD as well, we have some officers there who are excellent. And so we do have a good foundation of local law enforcement, I think, here, don't you think?
Absolutely. And TPD has done just phenomenal work on child sex trafficking cases. Their special victims unit with Sergeant Sonia Bush and with Beth Bascom have done remarkable work in really close collaboration with DCF. They've identified over 40 child sex trafficking cases just in the last 2 years right here in North Central Florida. So really kudos to local law enforcement for the really promising practices that they're introducing right here in Leon County.
Well, because this goes beyond just the impact on victims, as horrific as that is, because I'm thinking Susan Turner and Derek Phillips, how can you folks, as a restaurateur, as a farmer grower, how can you compete with organizations that are paying their help, sometimes not at all? How do you do that, Susan? I mean, come on.
It's tough. It's definitely tough. And we're a small business, too. And you have to look for resources and you have to look for sources. And, being part of this organization, I'm exposed to a lot more than a lot of other small businesses are. So it's keeping your antenna up. It's asking the questions. Just like we've all said, when I talk to a purveyor, I'm like, and they're big. They are nationwide purveyors. And I'm like, where does this come from? Where does that come from? Well, nobody's ever asked me that before. So it starts that chain of, asking the questions and getting to the bottom of it. And I think, I'm just listening to Terry and Robin, and honestly, this is all happening. It's almost like a grassroots movement that has started all this. And it's the small people just building and building and building the momentum. And it's going out to the farmers markets, talking to the farmers, and they're like, wow, yeah, that's interesting. We'll be a part of this. So it's just been out there and, talking it up and educating people.
Well, Derek, let's go grassroots here. As far as your organization here, the Handsome Harvest Farm and other like-minded folks who are part of the Red Hills Farm Alliance and growing your own stuff and getting it out there, you don't have a major distribution chain like a lot of the, other producers. So where can people avail themselves of what you guys grow and sell?
Absolutely. There's a growing movement in Tallahassee of people that have decided they want to dedicate themselves to farming. And there's no way to really compete with the amount of money that's coming in for the commercial organization. So most of these farms aren't doing it for the money, let's say. But the way that people can help support them is definitely through the Red Hills online market. That's rhomarket.com. And it's sort of like a local buyer's club where you pay a small fee at the beginning to get signed up, which supports this. We have about 2 or 3 employees there. And what that allows you to do is shop online every week starting on Sunday morning. So local producers put pictures and descriptions up of their products. The purchasing is done in between Sunday and Wednesday. Wednesday morning, that purchasing closes, and that gives the farmers time to harvest their produce for Thursday delivery. So folks can actually get home delivery for their products, or they can pick them up at the Northwood Mall at North Monroe and Tharp Street. And another really nice way for people to support local farms is to go to the Tallahassee Farmers Market at Market Square. Every Saturday we're there from 8 until noon. There's an opportunity to speak with the farmers, and some of the products that they can get are local, seasonal, organic fruits, vegetables, mushrooms, as well as meats, eggs, that's chicken, beef, and pork, goat products, fresh bread, microgreens, homemade soaps. Every week it's different because people make things and they bring them. And you'll be able to try new products. And if you're not sure how to use it, you can talk directly with a person who grew it from seed and they'll tell you how they cook it because we eat what we grow.
Well, that means then that the rumors of the demise of the Market Square Farmers Market have been vastly overplayed, right?
Absolutely. We have been sort of on the chopping block for the last 3 years, but I can assure you that we have a full market every Saturday, and it's going to be that way for the foreseeable future. We've been working with a development company out of Dallas, Texas, who's wanting to demolish the plaza and turn it into a parking lot for the new movie theater that's going there. And they've assured us that we'll have a spot until at least August, but that date always seems to change. So what we will do is we will stay together as a group of farmers, and when it is time to move, we will let everyone know. But until then, we're there every week.
And we got to talk here about pricing, because that has always been the bane of small business, whether it is a little store on the corner or a farm like yours. How do you compete with the monstrosities who have vastly greater volume to keep those prices down? How do you guys compare?
You know, that's a great question. And I think a lot of people are surprised that the prices, there isn't as much sticker shock as you might imagine. And especially when you start bringing those products home and eating them, you realize that you're willing to spend a couple of dollars more here or there so that you can eat healthy food. I'll tell you what, even having a couple of extra customers coming and spending $10 or $20 is a significant That's a significant purchase for a small business like we are out there.
Okay, yeah. Whereas with Green Giant, it might not mean that much, right? We are talking about, well, good things to eat, but also human trafficking here on this edition of Perspectives. You are always welcome to be part of the conversation, and we got some calls lining up here at 850-414-1234. You can also drop us an email, perspectives@wfsu.org. A quick timeout. We'll be right back. We're back on Perspectives, and thank you for being a part of the action as well as we go to the phones during this discussion of human trafficking and the outflow from that. Let's go to line two. Reed is hanging on. Reed, it has been a long time, sir. Where have you been keeping yourself? Hey, Reed.
Hey, Tom. I'm sorry. How's it going, man?
Hey, it's going well. How about you?
Oh, I'm keeping body and soul together.
Well, that's good. Yeah, the separation can be painful, I understand.
Yeah, about as painful as the shingles and the struts.
Yeah, there you go.
Are still not together, but hey, you know, you take what you get. At any rate, I was fascinated by your question regarding the distribution and how people who are growing and marketing their own stuff can achieve that. You know, when I was in North Carolina, I lived outside of little town in the Piedmont, and there were a couple of privately owned farms. These guys worked them themselves, and both of them out there decided the best way to efficiently do this was through the honor system. They would actually set up stands with a box. They would put their produce and things out, and they would price them accordingly, and then you drove up, picked out what you wanted, priced it out accordingly, and put the money in the box and drove away. And these guys, when I finally asked them, and they both told me, if I stood there all day as a clerk, I wouldn't make as much money on the stuff as I do when I collect it in the evening. Because people won't steal the stuff. People are inherently thankful that they're getting their daily bread. And I wonder if any of the small farms and co-ops around Tallahassee area are trying the same thing.
Oh, the honor system then, Derek. He's taking notes here, Reed. I think you put a you put a little kernel of an interest in the frontal cortex here.
Well, sure, Reed. I think that that's a great model, especially for farms. We have some urban farms popping up in the south side of town and in Midtown, and I think it would be a potentiality for them. And I know that it's absolutely legal to do here in Florida. Of course, for us, some more rural farmers out in Gadsden County, it's more difficult to do things like that. But I think that that's a great model that could absolutely have some potentiality here in Tallahassee proper.
With the proliferation, though, of so many businesses, and I'm thinking, of course, Amazon and all that sort of thing, where we have gone to essentially an international situation, are we beginning to bits and pieces, dribs and drabs, go back to, like, Derek, your operation, which is what I grew up with in a very rural part of Western Maryland, where all of the fresh produce came locally, and it did go to the local supermarket, the A&P or the Acme or whomever, because that was where the distribution chains were set up to handle that, not to bring stuff in from California and Florida.
Absolutely. I think that people are starting to sort of develop a craving for that, and they search out for it. How can I find something that was grown within 100 miles of my house? How can I find something that's fresher and it's chemical-free? And I do think that there's a rebounding against the sort of globalization, against the sort of Amazon and Walmart model, where people do want to have more local connections and they want their money to stay in the community. So I do see that. And I am finding that small and local restaurants are asking us for produce. They'll call us. And the same for locally owned grocery stores. They want local produce to come out there. So I do see that come. It's up and coming.
And Terry Coonan, perhaps a situation where you are no longer dealing with the giant conglomerates where human trafficking can hide in plain sight.
Absolutely. And, you know, Tom, this is an interesting topic. One of the things I have my law students do at the FSU Law School in the human trafficking class that I teach there, I have them get on a website. It's called slaveryfootprint.org. And what it does, it asks you, and anybody can do this, it will ask you, what are the different commodities that you buy? What kind of running shoes? What kind of smartphone? What kind of cosmetics? What kind of food do you buy? And it will then process all that information, and it will tell you, first of all, how many slaves work for you. It will look at what are the products that you buy and what's the likelihood that somewhere in a large company's supply chain there was slavery that was involved in that. What it also does then, it also tells you who are some of the preferred companies, companies that are operating in a quite transparent way, companies that have actually scrutinized their supply chains. It's a great exercise for students and I think for consumers, because it's a great reminder how all of us as consumers, we're the ultimate key to abolishing human trafficking, because we have tremendous amounts of power in terms of where we put our consumer dollar, as Derek mentioned, that, and the difference it could make for a small farmer when we go to pay $10 or $20 at the local farmer's market, or if we buy chocolate from a slave-free chocolate company. It's just a great reminder that in the middle of all the complexity that we face as consumers and as global citizens, that there's some really interesting efforts on both accountability and sort of enhancing our ability as consumers to buy from companies that are not engaged in modern slavery.
You're telling us to take personal responsibility, Mr. Coonan.
I am. Boy, professors have a way of doing that, don't they?
Let's get to Katie. She's hanging on here, line three, very patiently, too, I might add. Hey, Katie, thanks for calling. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. It's coming late to the conversation. So a while back, there was some controversy as to what is certified organic, and is there any kind of regulation process that validates certified organic?
Boy, that is that's a good one. Derek, since that's your produce, right?
Certainly. Well, what I can tell you is that in order to be certified organic, there's a third party that comes in and evaluates your crops. They take tissue samples, they take in all of the seeds that you purchase and any inputs that you put in. So there is a process in place it started from the federal level, and then it's third parties that come in and evaluate. Most of the local farms in town are not USDA certified organic. That's why it's important to meet your farmers and talk with them, because most of us don't want to be using any harmful chemicals because our farms are our homes. Our pets are there, our families, people have kids working out there with them. So there is a difference. When you go on the grocery store, more commercial side, it's important to look for the USDA certified organic. But when you're talking about local produce, that local stamp where it's coming from, maybe less than 20 miles away, tends to, for a lot of people at least, it's more important than getting an organic produce that was grown in the deserts of Nevada or California, something like that.
And you know what's so interesting about this to me is that everybody does focus on organic, but when you think about this issue of slavery and what the labor has you know done to create your food or to deliver the restaurant meal, there really isn't anything that's 100% on that, especially local. So there is fair food designations, but that's a really long list of labor practices that are certified. Sometimes you see things called ethically sourced. That could also be an indication that there's fair labor practices involved. But one of the things we want to do here locally is give sort of a forum for those businesses, restaurants, purveyors, farms that are slavery and trafficking free and feature them, whether it's going to be on STAC's website or other places where people could then go and look and say, where are the places where I can buy coffee? So, for example, Red Eye Coffee wants to be part of our program, and they have gone through the kind of all the steps to see that where every coffee bean comes from that they serve, it's been from a place where there is not, you know, slavery and trafficking. So we want to kind of give a voice to that. And I don't know if we're going to be able to be sort of a good housekeeping seal of approval, but that's the idea. And as we go forward, a part of the vision of this meal and this project and this event that we're doing is really to sort of build awareness. I think one of the most gratifying things from last year was having people say, I didn't know I had a choice. I didn't know this was even going on. I now know that I can, as a consumer, as Terry said, make something of my choices, spend my money where I know that things are more responsible. So that's one of the things that's exciting about this event and that that we're working toward with STAC.
Well, a perfect opportunity then to talk about the nuts and bolts of the event, Robin, if you would, again, coming up later on this month at the Turnbull Center.
Exactly. It's going to be on March 28th, which is a Thursday evening at the Turnbull Center. You could look at our website, surviveandthriveadvocacy.org, and get all the information about being a sponsor, ticket sales, anything you might want to do. We also have an ability for you to find out more about other resources in our community. We certainly also on our website, let me just say, we haven't mentioned it yet, there is a national human trafficking hotline that if anybody suspects trafficking, whether you're one of the farmers who's out there and you might see it, you can call that. That's 888-3737-888. And we'd like everybody to know about that too, to get help to victims.
And I think that came up yesterday. The new Lieutenant Governor of Florida, Jeanette Nunez, was in to do an interview, which will be featured on tomorrow night's Capitol Report at 6:30 Eastern here on WFSU Public Media. And she mentioned that human trafficking was a big problem. Why? Well, multiple reasons, but a major indicator was the fact that so many of the calls to the national hotline originate in Florida.
Third in the nation.
Number three.
Yep, absolutely. Also know that, too, every third Friday of every month, STAC does a training from 1 to 3 at the Kearney Center. This Friday, coming up in 2 days, we've got one featuring human trafficking and the schools. So we really encourage people, if they're interested in that, they can go to our website or just email us at STAC@surviveandthriveadvocacy.org so we can get you registered. But those are community events where everybody can come. It's free, certificate training, and we'd love to have them.
Child labor has been illegal in this country for years, but I get the impression that perhaps human trafficking networks aren't quite that, shall we say, deliberative about obeying the law when it comes to kids. Are a lot of kids trafficked?
Significant numbers are. A number of the victims that we've been working with from the Panhandle are as young as 16 years old. And a number of these children were brought in. They were actually unaccompanied alien minors. They call UAMs in the law field. They were brought in. One of the children that we've worked with was held for 2 years in detention in San Antonio, was then paroled to his sister in Baltimore. But he eventually came under the control of a trafficker who was able to recruit him, really to convince him to come down here to Florida where he could make money. So that, again, as a 16-year-old, he was working 60 hours a week with no safety precautions at all, wasn't fed, was one of the 18 people sleeping on the floor of a single-room trailer out in the Bristol area. So that, yeah, children are still at risk. The largest group of sex trafficking victims that we have, Tom, they're our own U.S. citizen children. They are typically the teen runaway or the child that has grown up with issues, might have had DJJ involvement, but that we're finding now that the largest group of sex trafficking victims in the United States, they're not foreign nationals, but they are our own U.S. citizen daughters. And that's an issue. DCF and the Attorney General's Office, actually the Florida Legislature, have done some excellent work on that. We have 8 safe harbor shelters around the state now. Really, they require intensive care. They say as long as 9 to 12 months of really residential treatment after they have been actually rescued from, say, a sex trafficking situation. But they're our own children, and they're being recruited oftentimes through the internet, through social media.
Well, going even beyond the Robert Kraft situation, again, innocent until proven guilty, et cetera, but this is what makes this possible. You cannot sell a product unless there is a customer. And in this case, do we crack down more on the customers? Robin, what do we do?
Well, absolutely. In terms of people who are out there, especially if there was a child involved in this, in a sex trafficking operation, the person who's the customer is a trafficker under the law. So that needs to be more, clear. And the other thing is we have to look at the kind of the wider scope of how people know that. So what is the awareness we get into the community that anybody who buys sex, who is out there, ought not to be given the kind of wink and nod, but there should be shame associated with that. There is a movement around demand strategies, they call them. But the other thing I was thinking about, too, just as you're mentioning this, is the work that's being done by people to get educated. One of them is our public health community. Some of the cases that we're seeing now have happened because nurses in county public health departments have had a training, have recognized it, have reported that to law enforcement. That certainly has happened here in the Tallahassee area in Leon County. It certainly happened down in Martin County in the Treasure Coast. So that is another piece of legislation I wanted to mention to you as well, that's going on for us to, we hope, get funding. Representative Osley and Senator Gail Harrell are promoting that so that there can be training statewide among all the county public health departments that we hope we can help them with.
But ultimately, as long as this is a source of money, it's going to keep happening, and that's where we come in.
And Tom, one of the important pieces of our Florida statutes actually imposes a $5,000 fine on anyone convicted of solicitation. And it's a really important way to get, as Robin mentions, at the demand side for prostitution and for sex trafficking. And we're hopeful that of those 300 men that have all been arrested down again in Jupiter, Florida, that our prosecutors will be mindful of that. That if these men have the money, the discretionary funding, if you want to think of it that way, to patronize prostitution and to create the very market in which sex trafficking can thrive, they have the money to actually pay that fine. And very importantly, about $4,500 of each one of those $5,000 fines, it goes to fund our safe harbor shelters. $500 of it goes to substance abuse programs for a lot of those young women and increasingly young men who are being exploited in trafficking rings. So we do have some great laws and some great strategies for addressing demand right here in our Florida statutes.
Well, before we bail, folks, which is going to be happening very, very shortly, again, a reminder that March 28th from 5:30 until 8 at the Turnbull Center on West Pensacola will be the Imagining Freedom Culinary Tasting and Fundraiser. You're bringing some stuff, aren't you, Derek? You have some stuff there?
Yes, sir. I'm going to bring whatever we have that week. We're in a a transitioning period, but we still have a lot of the fall greens hanging in there, so we'll be able to bring quite a bit of different stuff.
It'll be a surprise. It'll be great. Okay.
We like surprises.
We do. And that is an opportunity to join a great group of folks for Slavery Free Farm Fresh Fair. Music, conversation. It will be a gala gathering for sure coming up. So we say farewell to Susan Turner, Survive and Thrive Advocacy Center, STAC board member, co-owner of Food Glorious Food. Thank you so much for coming in, Susan.
Thank you.
Derek, of course, owner and grower, farmer, Handsome Harvest Farm out there in colorful Quincy. Thank you so much for being part of this, and we'll see you during the Survive and Thrive event coming up at the Turnbull, Derek.
Thank you, Tom.
To Terry Coonan, Executive Director, FSU Center for the Advancement of Human Rights and STAC Community Partner. Thank you, Terry. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Tom.
And we will see you at Lake Ella on Saturday. Begora, we shall. And Robin Hassler Thompson, Survive and Thrive Advocacy Center Executive Director. As always, thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you, Tom. You're just wonderful to have us on again.
We will have you on in future, before you know it, Robin. Perspectives produced by WFSU Public Media and Tallahassee Technical Assistance from Taylor Cox and, of course, Lydell Rawls today, and I'm Tom Flanagan. On March 30th, the Tallahassee Symphony Orchestra will be teaming up with the Morehouse College Glee Club, along with the Florida A&M University Concert Choir at Ruby Diamond Concert Hall. They'll be presenting Ode to Joy, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. We'll have a preview next week right here on Perspectives.
Copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.